Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on the Heritage Radio Network, every Tuesday from roughly 12 to 12:45. Joined, as usual, in the studio with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. How you doing?
Good. That pizza's called the Slammer.
Really? Mm-hmm. The Hammer and the Slammer?
Yeah.
So what's on this pizza from Roberta? By the way, today we have to go shoot at Food and Wine. Maybe we'll talk about it later. And so we have to take our lunch during our commercial breaks today. Boo-hoo. So what's on this pizza, the Slammer?
It's collard greens and prosciutto, I think.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know. Joe, what do we got on this pizza here?
I don't think he knows.
I don't know. I'm not a restaurant. I'm not actually working in the restaurant. I just bring the pizza.
Yeah, but you know, I don't know.
It's my fault. I should have read it more closely. All I saw was greens on top.
See, at Roberta's, they had these pizzas with greens on them, and Stas and I love the pizzas with greens on them, and then whenever we want one, they're like, nah, not today.
Yeah.
Greens today. I love greens on pizza, by the way. I like them when they're cooked down, as these appear to be, and I like them when they're
fresh,
not cooked down. Yeah, I like them both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a good product, greens on a pizza. Didn't mean to put you on the spot there, Joe. How you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. I'm just a little red in the face now. But,
As you said, you don't work at the restaurant. It's not your job. I just thought maybe you would had it and you would, taken note of.
I'm going to start up my own pizza blog for all the Cooking Issues listeners about all the Roberta's pizzas. Maybe someday.
I just stuck the headphone cord in the pizza. Such a party foul. So while we're on the topic here, Nastasha, you said to bring it up.
Okay, all right, we can do it.
Yeah, so Nastasha and I have an ongoing kind of feud battle. Is it accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
One of many.
One of many, but one we're willing to share. And so, some of you may know, I have two kids and a wife, right? And I've kind of been through this whole scenario in New York, by the way. And not so easy being a mom in New York if you want to, go outside. You can't, lock yourself away in your tiny apartment all day. You go freaking bananas. And so I am not in the least bothered by any sort of public display of feeding your babies, if you get my drift.
Breastfeeding.
Yes, breastfeeding the babies. Mm-hmm. And Stas here is bothered by it. You want to talk about that?
Well, it's just that Roberta's especially is a breeding ground for these women who take their entire breast out and don't cover it up.
But just don't look at it. It's so easy not to look at people.
Like, why don't you just cover it with, a nice... They make stuff like that. You could get a nice scarf to put over it. Why do you need to show it?
I just don't think that it's not about you. You see, you're looking at it like it's about you.
But isn't it distracting?
No.
If you're eating in a restaurant and a woman has her breast out, it's always at Roberta's. You have pizza in front of you, you have cheeses, you have,
What the heck does the pizza and the cheese have to do with it?
Lactic stuff.
Oh my goodness.
And then there's the lady next to you with her breast out.
Joe, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, Joe, what do you think?
I see it from both ways. Mm-hmm. My thought is that, yeah, you can just avert your eyes, but as soon as you started going about the cheese, I don't know, that was a little much for me.
Well, that's just because she's got a demented mind. She makes connections that don't exist.
I want writers or callers or listeners or whatever to weigh in on it.
Hey, you know what I want? I want mothers to be able to go out and eat whenever they want.
I think they should do it. Obviously, they have to do it when their baby's hungry, but cover it up in a public place.
That is painful. If you do not feed when...
I'm not telling them not to. I'm saying cover it up. Cover it up.
All right, whatever. I don't see why it's
would
like,
you like to, let's say that a man had to do it with a different appendage.
That is crazy. That is crazy.
Like, wow.
That is a crazy, crazy, crazy statement.
Whoa.
I cannot believe that you have said this on the air. Now, I want you people out there. This is a little taste of what it's like.
Well, a
little bit of a taste.
It. Somebody had to say it.
No, nobody had to say that. Call in. call in your responses to Nastasha or any other questions, cooking or otherwise, to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Longtime listener and supporter of MoFad, by the way. Lucas wrote in says that a longtime listener of the show. You know, he was a he's now a finance guy, but he used to be involved in super low temperature physics.
Cool.
Which is kind of interesting. I think he was saying he was dealing with what do they call it? Like Einstein? What is it? Kind of condensates. Super, super hyper low temperature physics. Anyways, so he has a deal for us. He says he shot a doe yesterday. You know, the doe, a deer, female deer. He shot a doe yesterday. He was hunting with a friend. He has half the meat, and he would be happy to donate some of this in the name of the progress of science in terms of us cooking game meats low temperature. And I hope it's, you know, some point I hope to go hunting too. But yes, please, please send us some. He says, unfortunately, the conditions of the deal with his friend were that all the offal from the first deer goes to his dogs, which is so weird. Your dog doesn't give a crap. Oh, my dog really only likes the deer that I hunt. My dog will eat any damn thing. You know what he likes the best now? Again with the nudging. Dehydrated lamb lung seems his current favorite thing. He can't get enough dehydrated and bread. Anyway, unfortunately, the conditions of the deal are that all the offal from the first deer goes to his dogs, but I have all the other cuts. Now, because I'm stupid, I butchered this myself, and since this is my first deer, it looks a little better than the first sushi I made, but, you know, it's kind of beat up. But certainly edible. Let me know if you guys are interested. Regards, Lucas. Yes, we are interested. Wouldn't you like that?
Yeah.
You like deer, right?
I don't think I've ever had it.
Come on, really?
Mm-hmm.
We'll cook the hell out of that, Lucas. Send
after
that stuff.
Thanksgiving.
Well, is it frozen? Yeah. Like, we're pretty much like in a K-hole right now. Like, at home, you know, well, we'll get into this later, but like, you know, I haven't been able to test any recipes. Chris Kohler sent us the tofu book by Nguyen.
Thank you
so much. We're super excited. I was reading through it, and then I realized, hey, you know what? I want to make tofu right now, but guess what? I have no kitchen. I'm moving. Yeah. I mean, not permanently, but like it's because my wife heard my rant about fryers last week. No, I'm kidding. She doesn't listen to the show. More on that later. But what happened was we're moving across the street, and the people who are buying my new apartment, they don't want my, you know, commercial fryer, my commercial hood, and my commercial range, and all that stuff. So I had to rip it out of the wall.
The people.
Well, I don't want to call out who it is. You know, yeah, they are relatives of mine. That's not the point. They don't want they don't want it. And so, so I had to rip it out with my bare hands. So now I'm back down to dorm room skills. I got a toaster oven, but I also have a sear saw.
Oh yeah.
So can I sear only something?
No.
Can I sear most things?
Mm.
What can I sear?
Everything.
Oh, Stas, you gotta get into the.
I know.
You gotta get into the. Like, you know what? Like, Christmas spirit. She's already in the freaking Christmas
spirit.
It's not even Thanksgiving
Black Friday
yet.
Spirit
and she's cracking out the Michael Bublé like it's like the end of the world is coming with the Bublés.
You encourage
Boobles.
That.
Now, yeah, okay, whatever. I encourage it because whatever. But, like, I'm saying, like, you know, like, we're doing something exciting and you
Everybody
came here, like, whatever. 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 Whatever.
No,
again,
of course,
now people, now you know.
A lot
now you
stuff,
know.
A lot of stuff.
Now,
a lot of stuff.
Now you know. Okay. John Stewart wrote in two cooking issues about a Serious Eats, and I couldn't figure out when the Serious Eats post was, but it was a Kenji Alt post. And he says, question one. This is what it is this, I forget what they called it. They called it something. What'd they call it? Like a Turk nut? What'd they call it? Like
oh.
A Turk?
Yeah,
Turkchetta or something like that.
Yeah,
it's a rolled turkey. It's basically a rolled turkey, breast rolled with the skin. I didn't see the original recipe to see whether he had meat gluten or not. But you know, I've been cooking rolled up poultry since I was a wee baby. Actually, you know what? Like even before I had meat glue, Jacques Pepin back in the day used to do ballotines of chicken that were stuffed with kind of like a dried fruit stuffing. And I used to make those things constantly, like in my 20s. Like that was my go-to. I used to love making that. This is slightly different. I think this meat glued. But Nils, you know, Nils Noren, formerly the FCI, good friend of mine, he, back when he was at Akavit, would turn any meat into a tube. Any meat. You hand him a meat, he turned it into a tube. He would take, you know, lobsters, turn them into tubes, salmon, tubes, chicken, tube, turducken, tube, beef, tube. And so, like, and the reason is that Nils liked the tube so much is that it cooks very evenly across it. And so, you know, Nils had a very good meat gluing and rolling technique, and it was actually his formation of tubes that caused him to be kind of like one of the top two. They went back and forth, Wiley and Nils, on who was using the most meat glue in New York City way back in the day. Anywho, so, you know, after I started cooking with Nils a lot, I too took up the tubes of meat as a thing, and so we used to turn, you know, just tubes constantly. Anywho, so that's what we're talking about. So Kenji does a spiced on the inside rolled up turkey breast with the skin around it that you low temp cook and then deep fry, which is kind of the classical low temp classic. Well, it's the low temp way to cook a bird like that in a simple fashion, as opposed to the skeletonized turkey nonsense that we do every once in a while. I can't do that this year. I don't have a kitchen. Crazy. Yeah. Sucks. We can't do that at the lab. We're not really set up for that at the lab.
No.
So I was like, please don't do it at the lab. The last time, I think I told this story, but the last time I did a major poultry project at the lab, actually we did one yesterday.
Yeah.
But the time before that, I blew up a pressure cooker and sprayed...
not the way you think.
No. I exploded the safety valve, and it was Old Faithful of chicken grease everywhere. I can picture that. I can smell it and picture it right now. Anyway, so the questions. The recipe calls, this is Kenji's recipe, calls for 60 degrees Celsius for 4 to 5 hours and then deep fry. For most tender cuts like chicken breasts and tenderloins, I think you meaning me, recommend keeping the time shorter to prevent mushiness. Thoughts on this, and what would you use for the time temperature on a turkey breast? I'll just go through all the questions first, and I'll answer them in whatever order my tangents allow me to. Question two. The recipe calls for slashing the inside of the meat, rubbing with spices, then rolling it and binding it with twine. Would this be a good application for meat glue transglutaminase to bind it together better? If so, how would you otherwise change the technique? Still rubbing the spices? Then dust with TG and roll, or would the spices interfere and or just be weird embedded in the meat? And question three. If using transglutaminase, which one would you use? I see RM, GS, TI, and Y. G, oh my, I like that. It's a good rhyme there. Available from John Stewart. Okay, so, or is he, didn't he call himself the other John Stewart once? The other John Stewart. Well, you know, since I don't know, again, like I said, since I don't know the John Stewart that you're referencing, is well, whatever. You're our John Stewart, John. Anyway, yeah, I would use meat glue on this. I mean, obviously, you don't have to use meat glue, but then if you don't use meat glue, you don't have to tie it. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there you go. And then you can just roll it in. Make sure you get a polyethylene-only plastic wrap if you're going to use if you're going to make the rolls with plastic wrap. And they're still on the Cooking Issues blog in the low-temperature section. There's a whole pictorial blah, blah, who's it on how to roll. I think I do a chicken there and also a salmon. Show how to roll it. Make sure that you use a non-PVC one. And smell your plastic wrap to make sure it doesn't smell all stanky and nasty. But the technique is all there, and it's, you know, fairly simple to do. I would put the meat glue. I don't think it really matters as long as you're not coating it with so much spices that the meat can't touch meat. I don't think it's going to really matter. You can use RM. RM is what I usually use. It's a powder, and you sprinkle it on because, I don't know, Nils would always say he hated the ones that were made into paste because he didn't want to add a lot of water to the inside. But if you have a lot of spices, you can use the GS, which is a slurry, and you paint it on, and you could paint it on, but don't paint too much. I mean, that's the problem. You don't want to add a lot of moisture. And then sprinkle the spices into the slurry and then roll it up, and you'll be good to go. And with something like this, you could actually you wouldn't even actually have to wait for it to set. Normally, you would wait for something to set, but as long as you're not cooking too high, 4 hours or so or overnight, as long as you're cooking down here in the 60 degrees Celsius range, you could very easily just heat set it, put it in the bath, and as it cooks through, it will set. It won't be as strong as it would be if you let it set in the fridge overnight, but it'll be strong enough for the application that you have here, and then you won't have any twine marks around it, right? So that takes care of questions two and three, right? Now, as to question one. All right, look, I'm sure Kenji has access to all the same programs and databases that, you know, that I have. And so his 4 to 5 hour cooking time at 60 degrees is probably based on what looked to be roughly 4-inch diameter cylinder, right? And so the issue is that he's trying to get up to the actual temperature, 60, in the center of a 4-inch diameter tube, and that does take 4 to 5 hours. However, right? If you look at his recipe, so I'll give you the recipe here for those of you that are interested. You can just look it up. I mean, you know, Serious Eats, it's right there. But preheat sous vide water bath to 140 Fahrenheit. That's 60 for you folks who cook in Celsius land. Add the turkey and cook for 4 to 5 hours. Remove and run under cool running water or transfer to an ice bath to chill for 5 minutes. That's, again, old standard technique we used to do to not overcook the meats. Remove from a bag and add any congealed juices to the gravy. Rinse carefully and thoroughly pat dry with paper towels. Trim ends for a more cylindrical shape if desired, although I would trim after you fry, unless there's a lot of skin on the outside. Heat oil to 400 degrees, it's hot, in a large wok or Dutch oven. Do not fill more than one-third of the way in order to allow for bubbling and displacement. He's overheating the oil here because he's going to get a large temperature drop as he puts it in. Carefully slide the turkey into the oil using spatula and tongs. It will not be fully submerged. Cover and cook. Shaking the pan occasionally until the sputtering dies a bit. I would just ladle over the top or roll it in the thing instead of having to, like, I mean, I don't know, whatever. But these are just semantics, you know, choice of cook. Anyway, about 2 minutes. Adjust the flame to a consistent 350, and then using a large metal ladle, spoon the hot oil. There you go. Over the exposed portions of the roast continuously until the bottom half is cooked and crisp. About 5 minutes. Carefully flip and cook on the second side, basting the whole time. So I guess he's covering it to get the temperature of the oil up faster by not having as much steam escape. That must be what he's doing here. But you're looking at a total cook time of 7 minutes at 350 degrees. And that is going to push the internal temperature of that. It's going to make a nice crispy skin, but it's going to push the interior temperature of the bird up considerably, which is why he's only cooking to 140 degrees. Now, 140 degrees is too dang – I looked at the pictures. It's cooked properly. But 140 degrees, 60 degrees Celsius, is too dang low for 99% of the people who are going to eat turkey breast. It's still going to have some of that weird translucent-y kind of hue to it. And you wouldn't want to eat that, would you, Stiles?
No.
Like the minimum you want to cook a turkey breast to in the real world, in real life, is about 63 degrees. Or even some people prefer 64. Dark meats, you're looking at like 65 is the lowest, really, 66 some people prefer. If you do low temperature cooking and you're careful and you've brined it, you can cook the white meat up that high, but, you know, whatever. These are the general numbers of what you want to cook turkey to. Now, in my opinion, turkey meat that is cooked for longer than about 2 hours low temperature, it's not that it goes bad, it's that it gets what I the texture is not as good if you taste it side by side with meat that was cooked to the same temperature at a shorter period of time. When you bite into it, it has a little bit of stringiness, mushiness. It releases its water in a way that I don't find as pleasant as I find ones that haven't been cooked for as long. Now, some people like that texture because we've done a bunch of side-by-side taste tests back when I was, you know, teaching low-temperature cooking back at the FCI. But it's just not what I like. What I would do, and if you were to get one of these things like Sous Vide Dash PolyScience's Sous Vide Dashboard, whatever it's called now, one of these programs that allows you to check it, if you were to just increase the temperature of the cooking water by a mere 3 degrees, you would chop the time down to around under 3 hours. If you were to then reduce the cylinder size from 4 inches to 3 inches, you'd chop it down to like two and a fraction hours to get it cooked up to this temperature in the center, right? And that, it seems to me, is a good way to do it. What I would do is do that and then ramp down the cooking temperature aggressively or put it in ice water a little bit longer so that you're not going to get an overcook when you put it into the fryer, because it's going to be easier to drop that temperature a couple of degrees than it is to raise it without overcooking. Does that make sense to us? Because anyway, so that's what I would do. I would cook it to a higher temperature and then drop it harder and then fry it without overcooking it. And I think that's going to be better. Especially you want to make it for a quick crust development. So I wouldn't actually cool it in the bag or in the I wouldn't cool it in ice water in the bag. What I would do is cool it down to – I would drop the temperature aggressively to like 50 or 52, pull it out hot and let the steam flash off of the moisture flash off of the bird, maybe even hit it with a fan or a hair dryer to put a pellicle on the outside. Do not use a used hair dryer on food, by the way, because you'll notice that it throws little pieces of burnt hair. What happens when people are blow drying their hair is hair particles get sucked into the intake, and then some of them make it in, and then they get kind of slightly incinerated, and then when you fire it again, occasionally it will fire out these little bits of half burnt hair particle crap.
That's how women get split ends.
What?
the over blow drying the hair.
I hate blow dryers. In terms of, I like they should just call them like, you know, kind of food dryers. They're awesome at that, like French fries and everything. But like people try to put a blow dryer on my head, I'm like, what the hell are you doing? My hair will dry. My hair will dry. Like, I'm not going to get a cold going outside. Like, do not blow dry my hair.
Yep.
Do you use a blow dryer?
Nope.
That's one of the reasons I like you, Stas. No offense to all you blow dry people out there.
They smell bad. They smell like burnt hair.
Yeah.
I guess for that reason.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, you're with me, right? Blow dryer, no good, right?
No way.
No, good on food, though. They're good,
good
for that.
Good to know.
But don't use a used one. Anyway, so that's what I had something else to add to this, but I forget what it is. Who knows? I'll think of it. I'll think of it at some point. You want to go to a break?
Yeah.
All right, we'll go to a commercial break. Come right back with Cooking Issues.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Questions 2-718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. You want to know why I'm one of the reasons why I'm a bad person?
Why?
Everyone else loves it. I hate Napa. I hate it. Napa Valley.
Oh, so do I. Yeah.
Yeah, I hate it. I mean, look, I like the people. I like the wineries. I like wine. But just that beating freaking sun. You know what I mean? What do you hate about it?
I don't like it.
Stas went to school at Stanford, so you know, so she's probably exposed to it more than I am.
Yeah, I don't like they're really like clean vineyards, you know, like very lines. I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah, I like the wine though. I like the wine. Mm. I don't know. It's also like so expensive over there, right? Mm-hmm. Who the hell are we talking? We live in New York. Please. Anyway, now I'm gonna get someone to be like, "You hate Napa, I hate you."
Well, no.
You know, what are you gonna do? I gotta be honest sometimes. You know what I'm saying? Got to be honest sometimes. At Clefs wrote in on the Twitter, said, cooking issues, any advice or techniques for roasting raw peanuts to then be milled into peanut butter and what temperature and stuff? Well, okay. So the thing about peanuts, this is another one of those these nuts questions. I love, like, anytime, like, I wish every week we would have some sort of, like, nut-related question, right? And you know what, like, that's probably the best one of the best songs. That's not like, there's so many good songs on that album, but Stas, you're not a big fan of that whole genre.
No,
even though you're from that area.
Yeah,
is that why you don't like it?
No, I just don't like it. Not my kind of music.
None of those. None of Mm-mm. No Dre, no Mm-mm. Snoop, no
Mm-mm.
nothing.
Mm-mm.
You're not, but you're also not an East Coast rap person either.
I don't like rap.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know how the heck we hang out. Okay. So the issue with making peanut butter is you're going to want a fairly high oil nut, right? So that leaves out the absolute royalty of peanuts, God's peanut, which is the Virginia peanut, which is a variety. And I've said this before on the show. If you have not gone out and purchased high-quality roasted, salted, please get the salted. Please, for God's sakes, get the salted. Salted. Don't get any flavors on it, though. These guys who make these Virginia peanuts, a lot of them, they make all these ones with flavors because they think that you need to flavor it. But Virginia peanut, the texture of a Virginia peanut and the size and the way it explodes in your mouth when you bite it does not require any sort of crazy flavoring. It requires simply salt and your mouth to eat and a fist to shovel them into your face, because that's what you're going to want to do with them. But a Virginia peanut, even though it is the best possible peanut that I've ever had. Like, by far, like, so far and away above any other variety. It's a variety. They can be grown elsewhere other than Virginia, but they're just called Virginia peanuts, and, you know, that's where I get most of them. I don't know where most of them are grown, but blows the rest. They cost more, and they're worth it. Here's what's going to happen. You're going to go on the – I hope. You're going to go on the internets.
I feel like you've talked about it.
I have, but some people, they don't know. They don't know. Go on the internets. You're going to look at it, and you're going to say, why the hell does this peanut cost so much? And then you're going to get it, and you're going to say, oh, that's going to be it, right? That's what I did. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So anyway, so don't get those for peanut butter, because that's a waste anyway of the amazing texture. And the Virginia peanut, I think, doesn't have as kind of a high oil content. If you're going to want something higher, like a Spanish peanut or something like that in oil, I would recommend roasting. If you're going to make peanut butter, you can put the salt in later, so it's not a problem. But everyone seems to say to roast it at 350 Fahrenheit, which, oh, man, I should have converted that to Celsius because at Clef's is in Japan, I think. Anyway, for like 15 or 20 minutes, as opposed to in the shell, the peanut board and all that recommends going for 30 to 35 minutes at that same temperature, 350. However, they don't tell you the real secret of roasting a peanut in shell. This doesn't apply at Clef's for peanut butter. Oh, and by the way, if you have a peanut that doesn't have as much oil, it's a simple matter when you're grinding nut butters to add a little bit of oil to it. And we used to do it all the time when we were doing – for instance, we would get California almonds. No offense, because I've had some good ones. Wyeth, from Labor, his grandpa's an almond farmer, and he got some really good nuts. But the thing is that majority of the California almonds that you get are some variety that has a very low oil content, because I guess they think that's what Americans want. Like, as opposed to Marconas, where you can see the freaking, like, oil on them. So delicious. But those nuts the average –
which nuts?
Those nuts. The average California almond there is almost worthless to make butters out of, because it has so low oil unless you add back a lot. Even pecans, which are fairly high oil, we would have to add some oil. Remember that when we were making all that stuff? Mm-hmm. We'd have to add some back to it. We would save a little bit of the last batch and make it kind of like a trying to get a perpetual motion nut machine out of it. And we used to pre-grind it and then put it in a Santha to get a really – which is, a melanger kind of – or Idli, like a dal Idli thing. Anyway, from India. And we used to get really good, really, really good textured nut butters. And then we would spin them in the centrifuge and get even better, awesome textured nut butters. We used to roast them all beforehand. But anyway, but none of that is going to help you if you want to put salt. Like, do you like eating peanuts in the shell?
I don't like nuts so much. I don't like peanuts.
Oh, my freaking God. What about you guys in the engineering booth over there? Are you a fan of the shell, the in-shell peanut?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, baseball style, yeah. Out there shelling in the freaking nutshells are everywhere. I like anything where you're supposed to make a mess and there's chaff everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't like when people eat the peanuts on the subway like that, though.
No, they should be shot in the face.
Yeah, right.
I don't mean it. There's a lot of violent things. I shouldn't say that. That's a turn of phrase I use not on the air typically. But what I mean is they're bad people. They're not bad. They're
rude.
They're rude. They're not thoughtful people. I take that back. What I said, that's not right. Anyway, but my point is that you should not – I don't like people eating any freaking thing on the subway at all.
No.
I don't want to see people – I mean, look, if you need to take a sip of water, no problem. But I don't want
What about a baby that needs to breastfeed?
Stas? You're such a freak. See what I'm saying, people? Anyways, my point is you know what I really hate? I hate the takeout food container open in the subway and the entire subway smells like takeout.
The lady was
eating
egg rolls next to me yesterday. Yeah. Subway. So gross.
Yeah. It's always like the high vinegar sauces and stuff you can smell, and the fried goods you can smell all over the thing, or like Subway sandwiches. I see that a lot. They're freaking messy. They're messy, people. Anyways, just don't do it. Right, Joe? Just don't do it.
No way.
How do we even – oh,
just
yeah.
Just wait. Wait 5 minutes.
Yeah, wait. But when you're outside or you're sitting at a picnic bench outside, like the peanuts in the shell. Anyway, the worst, though, is when someone hands you one and they're not salted. Don't you hate that? I hate that.
Yeah.
I want salt on those suckers.
Yeah, definitely.
So here's how you do it. If you want to salt the nuts before you roast them, the simple kind of boneheaded way without technology is to just soak it in a salt brine for a long time, then, you know, rinse them off a little bit and roast them, right? That'll work. But, oh, sorry, dehydrate first below roasting temperature, because if you don't get the moisture back out before you roast it, you're not going to be able to get all the moisture out before it gets too brown, right? So you need to take them back down to a normal kind of ambient moisture content at a low non-roasting temperature, either in a dehydrator or on a super low oven with the lid with the door open with a towel, you know how you do if you don't have a dehydrator, and let them really dry out before you roast it proper at like 350. But the baller, really biddly baller way to do it is to throw the peanuts and a brine and whatever other flavors you want into your vacuum machine and do rapid infusion into the peanuts, and you can infuse them almost instantly, so you don't have to wait for the stuff to soak through like you would with a normal brine, that we have to wait hours for the brine to make it through. So then you could make your brine, suck a huge vacuum, let the air back in, boosh, the brine will be pushed into the peanut, dehydrate in a low oven until you break one open, feel it, make sure it's dehydrated, and then roast it off, and you're good. We have a caller. You're on the air.
Mr. Dave Arnold.
Howdy.
Jeremiah Bullfrog, how are you, sir?
Hey! Doing well. How's it down in Miami land?
It's a balmy 81 degrees.
Nice. What's up?
I just called the chat.
Nice.
When can I get my hands on one of those Searsols, sir?
Well, so we're still making them by hand in the basement of the lab at 54 Eldritch. So, right now...
Teeny little elves with glasses and tweezers are assembling them as we speak.
I like to think of Piper as an elf with glasses and tweezers. But yeah, so literally that's what we're doing. So right now we only have a couple that we're using for shooting, because we're finishing the Kickstarter shoot on Thursday, and it's going to go up on Black Friday. But Monsieur Bullfrog, you are definitely on the list. You are on.
So what you're saying is I have to send Santa Claus a letter and proclaim my love for all things that heat stuff up very hot.
Yes, that's true. And also, like, here's a good question. So technically, in a food truck, you're allowed to have the handheld propane tanks, technically.
Are you asking me or are you telling me? Because I sure as hell don't know.
I was asking. I don't know. But the... yeah, so when are we looking at delivery on this thing?
April.
We're going to try to get April? Yeah, so the Kickstarter will be over right around the Christmas time, and then we're looking for hopefully – and really that soon, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, we're going to be busy. But the ones that we make now, you know, the proto ones, are literally they're all welded by hand in the basement, and so they're what's the PC term now? Budget. They're budget.
Mm-hmm.
Not the materials, just the workmanship. But we're going to get them actually made, you know, for real in we don't know where. We have a couple factories we're looking at, but we're going to get them made for real.
So what you're saying is for real, they're being made in China in some basement by teeny little Chinese elves.
Could possibly be made in India by small Indian elves as well. It's not sure, because both China, I mean, India for many years was kind of the stainless. The issue is that, you know, we can get fairly competitive price on like the high tech stuff, like the insulation and the mesh that we use, but stainless fabrication is just you're completely priced out of existence in the U.S. for this kind of a thing, and so we're, you know, that's the kind of stuff that traditionally you would get a lot, and like a lot of the barware is made in India, but over the past decade or so, China has really kind of rocketed forward to challenge, and I think they've superseded India in terms of their stainless manufacturing, at least in terms of what's imported into the U.S. and the cookware department. So it's a question of which one you're going to go to, but it's just phenomenally, you know, the tooling costs and everything are phenomenally expensive. And since we don't know that we can make enough of them to afford the initial kill on the initial cost on the tooling for a U.S. operation on that, we just don't know if we can do it. We're looking to hopefully assemble here, though.
It's just going to go bonkers. I mean, you're going to put that thing up, and it's just going to exceed anything that I think you ever could have imagined, you know?
Well, from your lips to God's ears, brother. From your lips to God's ears. But don't worry. If you want, look, you know, Jeremiah, old friend of the blog, back in the blog days, you know, at the French Culinary Institute. So you know,
I believe I sculled with you guys up in the lab at one point.
You did, and also, if you remember, you were the one that made us test out whether or not agave syrup was indeed did make a difference in margaritas.
Yeah, I secretly just wanted to drink margaritas that day. I was a little hungover, and I was like, let me just throw this out there. We'll all be drinking margaritas. It's going to just, you know, it's going to turn this class up a notch.
Yeah, that's true. Did I ever tell you that I found out, figured out the science behind why they're so different?
I believe we were having cocktails during ICC, and you did lay that theory on, and I'm going to test it out on my own. I'm a big margarita fan.
Yeah, well,
I'll do my own research, and we'll compare notes.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what I think, just for the benefit of the folks out there. The agave is extremely high in fructose. And fructose is interesting as opposed to sucrose in that its sweetness hits you right away and then leaves very quickly. So if you use agave, you're using something that's very high in fructose. So when you drink the margarita, you get a real hit of sweet right away, but it doesn't linger, whereas the lime lingers. So you're not left with a cloying sweetness. You're left with this kind of lingering lime flavor in the margarita. There's still some backbone of sucrose there from the Cointreau, but like the initial kapow hit of the sugar that you've added is in a fructose form, which seemed to work well in the margaritas back in the day. That's my theory. Welcome to it.
All right.
Well, you're on the list. We'll be telling you when you get out.
Put an order in. Can you just put an order in for a margarita pizza, and after the show, just eat that for me, so I feel like I'm part of the crew.
I'll tell you what. We're going to do a food and wine shoot, but next week I will. You will be an official in absentia crew member here, and we will order a margarita pizza. I'll pound it for you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, brother.
The hammer.
Bye.
Take care, guys. Thank you.
All right. Cool. Talk to you soon. All right. Now. What are we talking about? I don't know. Who the hell knows what I'm talking about? Alex wrote in last week about fryers, and I gave a long spiel about how they might void the insurance in your house, and that they could have safety issues, and go. And apparently, I am frightened myself.
You convinced yourself, yeah.
I mean, I'd already purchased my new deep fryer for my house because. But look, like it's kind of like who I am. It's like whatever. Anyway, so here's what he wrote back. Hello, Dave. So last week you answered my email about fryers, and my wife skipped past your comment that a fryer is a good idea for cooking. Shouldn't skip that part. You know what I mean? And leaped on the burning down the house prospects. Valid point. Your wife has valid point. So a large deep fryer in the home no longer appears to be a viable option. As I've never seen a countertop deep fryer with recovery times useful for frying, it looks like I'm back to stock pots and Dutch ovens. While the thermal mass of cast iron is appealing, I've seen some sources online that iron will react with the oil, degrading the quality or imparting off flavors. Is there any truth to this? Yes. Also, what is the chemistry beyond oxidation going on in the fry oil that makes it break down and turn? Alex. Okay, look. Before I get into it, let me just say, I looked around and there is, I forget whether or not you said you lived in an apartment or you live in a house, right? Because one of the things I've always maintained is that if you live in a house with an outdoor space, like that's where you should put your fryer, right? And there is a company, from Homer, Louisiana. These guys are crazy. They're crazy. They're called R&V, like RV, like recreational vehicle, but not recreational vehicle, like R and ampersand V works in Homer, Louisiana. Their website is CajunFryer.com. So you already know it's going to be good. Their website like Cajun Fryer, how could that be bad? And these guys sell, it's intended for home, right? Which means it's not going to void your homeowner's warranty because it's intended for home. A real, honest to God, outdoor, so it's got a cover on it, propane-fired tube deep fryer with a cold zone. It's freaking nuts. It's awesome. It's not even that expensive compared to other commercial stuff, and it's meant for home, so you're good to go. You just have to fire it up, not inside. It's not meant to go inside. These guys also have some insane griddles. They also make a like, crazy pressure smoker that looks like a giant autoclave and uses like burbling percolated water. I don't think the pressure's that high. I couldn't figure out from their documentation because they don't tell you how high the pressure is. How high it is, and I could have calculated if I knew exactly the height of the water that they're pushing through to generate the pressure, but I couldn't. So, hey, whatever, I couldn't do it. But those guys are genuine nut jobs making those fryers, and so I would go to them. Another thing I should tell you is that I also forget whether or not you said that you're good with building things or not. Do you remember?
No.
I don't remember, Stas. I don't remember. What you can do is build your own fryer, and I've done this. So what you here's some basic math for you. My fryer, or the one I just threw it out, but the fryer that I had and the fryer that I'm going to get has approximately 90,000 BTUs for about 5 gallons of oil, about 35, 40 pounds of oil. And what that means is you're looking at around 18,000 BTUs per gallon, and that equals about 5.2 kilowatts. That is a freaking lot. Out of a, and you know, as you rightly say, home fryers, they don't have really the ability to heat that much because you're looking at roughly 1,500 watts max, 1.5 kilowatts. If you have a 220 circuit, then you could probably boost that to about 3 kilowatts. Now you're getting close to the amount of power you need to heat a full gallon of oil. So here's what you could do if you're handy. You could buy a temperature controller, buy two, right? You want you don't need PID. You don't want PID. You want what's called a bang-bang controller, something that turns the heater on and then turns the heater off when you're done. Okay, strap one of the strap a control bulb or a sort of thermocouple directly to a heating amp. Oh, go on McMaster.com and get the longest. You're gonna need 220 for this, not 110. 220. Get the longest bendable immersion heater that you can get at the highest power that your 220 circuit can deliver. Right now, you want to bend. You got to get a pot. You want a pot that's tall, fairly tall, for its size. Right, and then you're going to put a grate, a rack in it. You're going to want to bend like special legs for the rack so that the rack sits fairly high in the pot. Right below that's going to be your cold zone. Right, and then you know, a couple inches, give yourself. Then you're going to rest the tube heater, the longest one you can do. You bend it into something that fits into the pan. The reason why you want it long is you want the longest, the biggest surface area possible. If you really have skills, you could put fins on it, but don't worry about it. Bend it up out. You have a thermocouple that measures the oil temperature, and then a safety one strapped onto it to shut the thing off. Make sure it's bang, bang. As soon as the oil, the temperature drops, you want it to go on full force. You don't want any PID action because it's going to slow down your recovery rate. Then you can do things like measure before you start frying with it. How you got to be careful. If you're worried about electrocuting yourself, don't do this. I mean, this is not safe. This is just something you can do at home. Anyways, I've done it before, and you can make a relatively decent deep fryer if you with a cold zone, if you have, if you're handy, if you're not worried about things. And, well, of course you are, though, because if your wife doesn't want you to deep fry, she probably also doesn't want you to be bending tubular immersion heaters and hooking them up on your stuff. But whatever, it's a good project. Stas is shaking her head and saying that I'm a jerk. Okay, back on to the pots. If you have dings in the enamel, you're going to have some iron. Iron is reactive. It's not nearly as bad as copper. Copper is like the ultimate enemy. I mean, if you think about it, what happens, old commercial deep fryers were regular steel and not stainless. And you would get a layer of polymerized oil on the steel that would just never go away. And then that would kind of protect it from further degradation. But in general, you're going to want to go stainless. Enamel should work fine. You don't really care about how much heat it's going to build up because you're using the thermal mass of the oil. You're not really storing so much energy in the cast iron. So I wouldn't worry about that too much. So I would also recommend going online. It's a little bit outdated. And getting a PDF copy of the Egan Press, which is put out by the American Association of Cereal Chemists, Fats and Oils books. It's extremely readable. And they have a whole section on deep frying. So you know, basically from them, what's going on is hydrolysis in the fat oil. So water is coming out of the fat oil, and the water, especially at those high temperatures, is causing breakdown of the fat into free fatty acids, you know, which are, you know, then cause oil breakdown. And so, you know, hydrolysis from water is one of your enemies. oxidation is one of your enemies, and this stuff's accelerated at higher – all this stuff's accelerated at higher temperature. Polymerization of the oil molecules is another enemy. And then also as you fry more, especially at higher temperatures on a pan, you're going to have food particles falling to – in a pot, rather. You're going to have food particles falling to the bottom. Since you are supplying the heat from the bottom, the hottest part of the oil is exactly where you don't want it to be, where all the settled crap is. And so typically what happens is you'll get very fast oil breakdown. You also, because you don't have a high enough power to recover fast enough your oil, you're going to be constantly overheating it. And the even minimal overheating of oil is incredibly bad for the life and the taste of the oil that you're using for frying. So, you know, that's just kind of a general range of kind of what's going on and how you're getting shafted. Like I said,
breastfeeding just started again.
Stas, please. Like I said, the best way around, you know, the best way to help yourself, even in a home frying situation, is to go to a commercial supplier, go to someone who supplies restaurants, and get commercial grade frying oil, where they've added antioxidants to it. They've removed the fatty acid components that are the most likely to degrade quickly, and they also they sometimes add anti-foaming agents, which also prevent the oil from breaking down. And so that professional fry oil is so much better than the stuff you can get at the supermarket that Stas and I have considered actually just buying a bunch of it and selling it to people like we know what we're doing, because it's so much better. You have to buy it in 5-gallon increments. So if you're using it, you know, relatively quickly, stored away from light, it shouldn't be a problem. They come in plastic cube. They come in like square cardboard. Everyone's seen these on the street. When you pass a fry joint, you know, like or you know whatever place that uses a lot of fryers, you'll see them on the curb there. They're those cardboard cubes with the plastic cube tainer in the middle of them. And that stuff's just fantastic. So if you get a hold of that, your fry game's going to go up immensely right away. What do you think, Stas?
Yeah.
Stas's like, I don't care. I don't care.
But, two more babies.
All Stas is thinking about is the breastfeeding. And people, I want you to know, this lady has a scarf over the baby's face. So Nastasha needs to step back. But So today, by the way, I'll just say this as we're going out. Today we're going to go to the Food and Wine, and we're doing a Thanksgiving shoot with the Searsall, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do some sort of fancy tech. I guess I'm not supposed to spoil it, right? But it's a similar technique to the one that I did back in the day for the hamburger with the exploding ketchup in the middle. Remember that with the shot where it's like gabloosh, for Eater way back in the day. But I'll give a little bit of a secret. What we did is we made Parker House rolls that are filled with stuffing. So it's just a thin layer of Parker House roll with stuffing on the inside. Those are pretty good, right, Stas?
Yeah, they were really good.
They were good. And remember – oh, did we get another Thanksgiving question? Oh, I looked up the turkey.
The one that Piper gave you last night.
So we had a question last week about using hydrogen peroxide, H2O2, to disinfect a turkey that was being cooked at low temperature. It was based on a blog post by Simon Quellen Field. And I looked it up. And the guy coats his entire turkey with bacon, by the way. Entire freaking turkey is like a, you know, like a pie is like a lattice.
Yep.
This is like a lattice of bacon. And it's extremely low temp. He put in the H2O2. I was not able to find any references to whether or not that would affect the flavor of the meat in any way. It's used in water, and presumably it'll react and you won't get it. But I don't know whether the extreme oxidation reactions are going to do anything to the flavor of the skin or anything. I wasn't able to find any references. And since I don't have a kitchen, I wasn't able to just soak a piece of chicken or something in H2O2 and then cook it off and see whether there's any residual effects. But rest assured, we will try this at some point. I feel like we got one more question in, Stas. We have a couple seconds. We have one in from at Raider Nicole. That was the one. Cooking issues. How do you prevent warmed over flavors in reheated chicken? And then it just says marinade, baked, or pan fried as questions. What you do is store the product away from oxygen. It's oxidative rancidity that's causing the warmed over flavor. So you can reheat gently in zippies, Ziplocs that you have gotten all the oxygen out of, and then just hit it with high heat to crisp off or do whatever you want. But the enemy there is storing it allowing it to cool and rest in contact with oxygen in the air. And remember to get your Thanksgiving questions in, because next week is last cooking issues before Thanksgiving. Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.